Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 145 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet and short story writer Brian McCabe speaks with Jeff Hattersley about why mathematicians are a bit like artists, how something being funny doesn't necessarily mean it's light, and the process of imaginatively recreating the worldview of a child.
Brian McCabe was born in a small mining community near Edinburgh. He studied philosophy and English literature at Edinburgh University and has lived as a freelance writer since 1980. He's a rare kind of writer in that he has achieved an equal reputation for both his poetry and short stories. He has published four collections of poetry, including Zero, an exploration of the world of mathematics, and it's a testament to his skill as a poet that he manages to make a subject most people would consider dull, exciting and indeed fun. He has also published three volumes of short stories, including the highly acclaimed The Lipstick Circus. His selected stories were published by Argyle in 2004. I met Brian at his home in the centre of Edinburgh on a very cold day in January. Hey, well, it's nice to meet you, Brian. I first got to know your work as a poet.
Okay.
And that is, I believe, how you started out. You came to stories after.
So. Yes, I started with poems when I was really quite young, actually. I was about 16, 17. I began to write stories when I was maybe in second or third year at university.
Right, so also still quite young, really, yeah?
Yeah, still quite young, yeah. I was at university, I knew other poets like Andrew Gregg, Ron Butlin, Liz Lochhead, and one day I announced that I'd written a story and they looked at me as if I was mad, because we all just wrote poetry at that point. Ian Rankin even wrote poetry at that point, believe it or not.
Right. So you were part of a group, who called themselves the Lost Poets?
That's right. It's an awful name, really, but... We did get together we organised readings, and we would invite a well-known author, unlike us, you know, some of the older writers like Norman McCaig or Robert Garioch or Edwin Morgan. We'd invite them to do a reading, and we would read, we'd be the supporting act, if you like, you know, and we had some music, and they were quite popular, these events, you know, we did them one a month, and then in the festival we used to do a week or so of the show.
I think that poetry readings are probably the best way for people to get into poetry, rather than reading them in books, maybe, you know, or they can bring a lot of people in.
Yeah, well, certainly for me that was the case. I went to readings very early on at the Traverse Theatre and places like that, and I heard most of the older Scottish poets reading before I read their work in their books.
Right.
So, and it was a great apprenticeship in a way, because, I don't know, the older Scottish poets were very good readers of their work, and it kind of emphasised to me and the others of us who were my contemporaries that the importance of communicating, you know, that poetry wasn't just some kind of abstruse way of expression, you know, it was a way of communicating with people. And, you know, you could find out if a poem works or not on that level when you read it aloud, you know. Yeah, but readings were really important for me as a young writer, and they still are, actually. I mean, I still really enjoy reading my work to an audience. There's nothing quite like it.
Yeah, I think most poets do. I know. I do. And I think your work, while it's often dealing with complicated concepts, it remains a level of accessibility, you know. Which do you think that came about because you had put readings at the top of the...
I think so, probably. I think that probably had a lot to do with it, accessibility. Accessibility is quite important to me as a poet. You know, I accept that sometimes poems can be difficult and they can be hard work, and they can still be rewarding. I mean, the first time I read... T.S. Eliot, I found it very difficult. You know, I was still at school. I was young, and I knew it had an effect on me in some kind of subconscious way or some kind of emotional way, but I couldn't for the life of me say what it was meaning. You know,
Yeah.
I found it difficult. So, I mean, I accept that some poetry is like that and works, can work in that kind of subliminal way. But most of my poems are accessible, certainly. They're not all ideas-based by any means, but some of them do frame a kind of concept or an idea. Yeah, I think sometimes to frame a complicated idea in a simple way is a kind of an aim of mine, a goal.
Yeah, well, I think that's what poetry should be, really, expressing something complicated as simply as possible. That often you find it being done the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Something quite simple being expressed in as complicated a way as possible, which I don't know why people do that. But
I know, I mean, when I'm, I teach creative writing at Edinburgh and at Lancaster, and the question I ask students most is, what does it mean, you know? What does that mean? Right. You know, or I write in the margin, meaning ? Because it doesn't mean anything to me. So, yeah, accessibility on that level is, I think, something to really be desired and really to be pursued.
Yeah, I've noticed that you've written quite a few sequences of poems. What drew you to that? Was that something you deliberately set out to write the sequence, or it just came about after you'd written one or two poems?
I think it just came about a bit. It's you know, you find yourself with two or three poems which are similar, either thematically or just because of what they're about or in the way that they're written. And, for example, you know, in my book of poems, Body Parts, I found myself writing one or two poems about fairly humble animals, creatures, you know, like a worm and like a spider, a cockroach. And I thought, well, this has the makings of a group of poems. So you write more into it then. You think, what else do I want to write about? And I mean, partly the reason why I wrote about these very humble animals was that Norman McCaig, an older Scottish poet, he used to live just along the road from here before he died, and I used to go and see him quite a lot. And he'd pretty much covered all the animals you might encounter in Edinburgh. You know, he'd done the foxes and all various birds and, you know, all those animals you might encounter in the city. So I had to kind of dig into the subsoil to find things that he hadn't written about, you know?
Yeah, I like the poems in Body Parts about the animals, and they're quite different though. Some of them adopt a quite sophisticated voice. Like for instance the cockroach one, where he's kind of almost making fun of the human beings around him, you know.
Yeah.
And so we discussed you suits us.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is doing that kind of thing in poetry. It does require this effort of the imagination to imagine, you know, how a worm would speak if it could speak in human terms, you know. So it does involve that effort of the imagination. And it doesn't work if you don't get it right, if it doesn't sound right, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's no point. If you do an owl, say, and it doesn't sound owlish, then, you know, it's not going to work.
No.
It's got to somehow chime with the creature and the qualities of the creature, the character of the creature. I think the one I enjoyed most, writing most, was the eel. I wrote it as a very short poem at first, and then I thought, wait a minute, I don't really know that much about eels. You know, I had some experience of when I was a boy, I went fishing once, and not with a fishing rod or anything, just with a bit of stick and a bit of gut, you know, and a bent pin, basically. And I caught an eel, and it just wouldn't die, this eel. I couldn't kill it. I mean, I knew that eels were real survivors. You know, it's difficult to kill an eel. So I took it home kind of stunned. I'd been hitting it with stones and stuff, but it still wouldn't die. And I took it home, presented my mother with it, and you can imagine how delighted she was to get this stunned eel, which the cat wouldn't even touch, I don't think. But so I wrote this short version of the poem, and then I thought, I need to know more about eels. So I went and researched it, and I researched a few of those creatures in that sequence. I read up about them, and you know, I found out about the eels migrating, and it's such an epic migration. It can take about 3 years there and back. And they always go to the Sargasso Sea, which is interesting. And it's a very dense sea, very murky, you know. And that's where they mate. And they often just die after mating, but sometimes they can swim back if they're young eels. And the elvers swim back. So during the course of the migration, they change from being a freshwater creature to a saltwater creature. And, you know, their liver changes and things. It's just an incredible transformation. So I tried to get all as much of that kind of stuff into the poem as I could, you know. But I liked the voice because the eel speaking in the poem is a bit like the sort of shop steward of the eels, you know. He's the one who's getting the migration organised, you know, and saying, right, boys, come on, line up and let's go, you know. We're going to the Sargasso Sea. I like that kind of voice of the eel who's responsible for the others, in a way. Yeah.
The most recent book of yours I've seen, of course, is Zero, which is a book, a big sequence about numbers and the significance of numbers and mathematical systems.
Yeah.
Are you a mathematician? Are you interested in maths?
No, I wasn't good at maths at school. I was all right, you know. Yeah. I think I passed my higher with a C or something. But no, I've never been particularly interested in maths. But the book started from, I wrote a poem about how we were taught to count at infant school. They gave us these kind of counters, a bit like large dominoes with spots on them, you know. And they'd have four spots, or they'd have five spots in a pattern, or six spots. And that's how they taught us how to count at my school. And I wrote a poem about learning to count like that. And then I suddenly thought, I wonder if recognising a pattern is important in maths, you know, if it's kind of basic to maths. And for the first time in my life, I went to the mathematics section of the library.
Yeah.
And I came home with all these books and I started reading about it. And, you know, I think my wife thought I was going crazy, I think, because I was writing like lists of twin prime numbers up on the wall and stuff, you know. Yeah. And my kids, I was demonstrating like the Meebus strip to my kids over the dinner table and stuff, you know. And I just got very interested in it, and I realised that maths is so important. It underpins everything. You know, you can't have a table and a chair without maths. You can't have anything, almost, you know, anything man-made without maths, you know. And it kind of really underpins our lives in very important ways. So just in the course of my reading, I started to write other poems about it. I wrote some about where, in a way, I was doing a similar thing to what I did with the animals and body parts, where I kind of gave a number a personality, like the number 11 became like an 11-year-old boy. So I did that with some numbers. And then I was reading about mathematicians and the history of maths too, and Pythagoras and all these strange ideas he had about earthquakes being caused by the dead being restless and things like that, you know. And So I just got very drawn into it, and it just grew. I mean, at a certain point, I did realise this could be a book. I could have just kept it probably as a part of a book, but I decided to go for it. And I think possibly I strained it a little bit, and one or two poems were maybe a little bit forced into the pattern, you know, because when you're nailing all your poems to one thing, you know, sometimes it can become a little bit contrived. But the thing is about maths and the history of mathematics is such a broad thing. It takes in all sorts of things, really. I mean, in a way, I don't really think the poems are just about mathematics or numbers. I think they're about people, you know. Yeah, but I was pleased that I managed to do a whole book on roughly kind of the same kind of thematic territory, yeah.
It's interesting that maths and, all science subjects and arts are often seen as in opposing each other. You know, they're not seen as, mutual studies, are they?
Yeah, I know. I don't know why, because, I mean, I know a lot of poets who draw on science
And
scientific topics, scientific subjects. I mean, Edwin Morgan is a prime example of that.
And, of course, a lot of poets, they use mathematical systems within what they're writing. You know, they'll have syllabic patterns.
That's
and
right,
so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And they may not be aware that they're using maths. They might not give it that word, but they
They are, yeah. Yeah, maths underpins music in the same way, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
One thing I learned from Edwin Morgan, older poet from Glasgow, was that, you know, poetry can really address anything. You know, it can address science, it can address physics, it can address anything, really. And, you know, I don't know if I'd have been able to write those maths poems, or if I'd even have thought of writing them, if I hadn't read Edwin Morgan's stuff.
Right.
You know, because he really made me feel liberated in that way that, you know, I felt, well, he can write a poem about Martians and things. He can write a poem about, which is the thoughts of a module, you know. So basically anything is fair game, you know.
And, sure. Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the book, and I weren't sure before I read it, you know. I thought, maths, do I really?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was great, you know. And I learned quite a bit too. I learned what a twin prime number is, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea what a twin prime was.
Right.
And I liked the central sequence in the book about the mathematicians' lives, you know.
Yes.
Some of those were very funny and sad as well.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
It's certainly an eccentric bunch who had some
times. Oh, very, very. I mean, I realised that mathematicians are a bit like artists, actually, because they will intuit a proof, a mathematical proof, before they can actually show it, before they can demonstrate it. So they know that something's the case intuitively, and then they have to work to try and prove it rationally.
Yeah.
But that's the way it happens. I mean, true mathematicians are a bit like artists in that sense, you know. And I didn't know that before I started to read about them. And yeah, they're very, very human people with lots of human flaws and faults and foibles. And I mean, stories like the one about Sophie Germain, who was a female French mathematician who dressed up as a man in order to study at the Academy of Mathematics in Paris. And it's just an amazing story, really, you know. The lives of the mathematicians were really interesting.
So has the general critical reaction to the book been good?
Yeah, it got good reviews. It had one or two reviews by people from the mathematical community,
right,
which were good. I think one of them pointed out a couple of errors, mathematical errors.
Right, okay.
But they were all for it, the idea of making these things more accessible and readable to people.
Yeah. So are you writing at the moment in poetry? Are you writing much poetry right now?
I do have some poems that I'm happy with, fairly assorted, so I'm not quite seeing a book there yet. I'm more working on stories, or at least I have a book of stories maybe two-thirds of the way complete.
So how many stories would you include in a book?
Usually about 16 or something.
16?
Yeah. Between 2,000-4,000 words each, something like, usually around that length. Occasionally I've written something longer, but they're usually fall into that kind of length.
Is there a common theme among the stories you're writing at the moment, or are they...
There sort of is, loosely a bit, in that I started to write, I wrote one or two stories about health and illness, especially among men, particularly Scottish men, because health is a real issue for Scottish men, you know.
Yeah,
Scotland has been called the sick man of Europe for various reasons. And so I wrote a couple of stories, two or three stories on that theme, and then I wrote more into it, talking about sort of men with problems, basically, and not necessarily physical health problems, but other mental health issues, or just, you know, having a difficult time in their life at a certain point. So a few of them are kind of loosely about that, but then two or three aren't, so I don't quite see how they fit yet. I don't really want to nail them all to this theme this time. I want it to have room for other stories to be in there. I think probably by the time the book's done, a reader will be able to see a bit of continuity in it.
I like a lot of the older stories that were set in psychiatric hospitals as well.
Oh, yeah.
Conversation Area 1 and Norman and the Man, for instance. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that you worked briefly.
I worked only for about a year and a half right. in a hospital in the art therapy department. And so I did draw on some experiences in there for a couple of the stories. Norman and the Man, certainly. And another one I wrote called The Full Moon, which was about a guy who's working in an art therapy department who's mistaken as a patient, a group of visitors. They mistake him, they think he's a patient. And this happened to me two or three times when I worked there, that I'd be sitting at the table doing something, gluing something together or whatever. And the psychiatrist would bring in visiting parties from abroad and stuff, show them around the art therapy department, because it was regarded as quite a progressive little department to have in this kind of hospital. And I was mistaken for a patient sometimes, once or twice, and it just gives you the most strange feeling that and that's what the story was about. It was about how do you define sanity and insanity? And if you take someone who's sane and put them in that context, they start to look insane, or they start to behave in a way that seems insane.
Yeah.
So the story was a lot about the context, really, of, what happens to someone when you class them as insane, It's trying to explore that anyway.
Yeah, I like the fact that there's in a story like Conversation Area 1, there's a lot of humour. When you read that, you can laugh out loud at some bits. The conversation of the mother that she's having with her son who's incarcerated, and yet at the end, the feeling is one of just sort of real devastation and loss.
Yeah,
it feels so sad.
Mm-hmm.
I like that kind of balancing out that you're pulling off there, making people laugh, but at the same time, what you're actually telling is a devastatingly sad story.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do. I mean, humour has always been important to me in my work, right from when I started. When I started writing poems, they were mainly things to try and amuse my friends. They were funny. They were meant to be funny. And it's always been very important in both my poems and my stories. But I don't think because something is funny means that it's light, and I think sometimes humour can make a point in the most direct way possible, And
yeah, I agree with that.
I think when you make someone laugh and then think, oh, wait a minute, what am I laughing at, this is terrible what I'm laughing at. Yeah, that's the aim, is to sort of have that effect, really.
Another sort of thread of your stories are stories that you're based, I think, in your own childhood, or mostly in your own childhood. And I think you have this great facility for seeing through the eyes of a child and recreating that world, that reality that we've all been in touch with, but most of us have forgotten.
The business of trying to get inside the mind of a child has been something I've tried to do quite a lot. It's difficult to do. It requires a real effort of the imagination to really remember what it's like to be that height and not to understand a lot about the adult world. To have the wrong idea about certain things in the adult world. Yeah, I think, people sometimes make the mistake of thinking that a child isn't capable of dealing with complex ideas. And I think they are capable of that. But the challenge in these stories, which use a child's point of view, is to do that in the language that is right for a child. That it's not too complex. And sometimes you have to invent new ways to say things using simple language rather than the adult terms you might use, And it's difficult to let go of your adult perceptions and really get into that child's mind. But that is the challenge in these stories, really. That has been the challenge for me, yeah.
I like the fact also that the stories, they're not written in the first person, which they're a very subjective point of view, the child's point of view, and yet it's in the third person. And
yeah.
How did you come about finding that technique? You're not tempted to write them in the first person, which is probably the most common way of doing that kind of thing.
I did write one story about childhood in the first person, but the others, yeah, you're right, I think they are in the third person. That technique of what you might call a value-laden third-person narrative, or I think sometimes called a close third-person narrative, where you are presenting a character's point of view within an ostensibly neutral narration, but it isn't neutral, of course. That technique, I think I learned that from some other writers, especially one that comes to mind is Bernard Malamud, actually.
So he's in it, what you'd call an influence, Bernard Malamud, yeah?
Yeah, in the short stories, certainly, yeah.
Who else in short stories, would you say?
Oh, God.
Well, aren't there so many people, really?
There's so many, yeah. There's so many, really. I mean, I think when I was starting to write, I would kind of sometimes imitate people. Which is a kind of, it's quite a good exercise in a way. Like, I would try and write like Raymond Chandler or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, end up writing a kind of parody.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn things from that as well.
Yeah.
You learn things from that. Yeah. These days, with students, it's Raymond Carver who's often,
right.
You know,
yeah.
He's often,
yeah.
People try to write like him. Not always with the best results either, you know.
Right, perhaps not.
No. But yeah, I think I learned a lot from reading other writers, and that was, that technique certainly, you know, that doesn't just come naturally. I saw how other people did it and learned from them. Yes.
That was Brian McCabe in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Brian on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 145, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 146, memoirist and travel writer Horatio Clare ponders the necessary pragmatism of the professional writer and shares a glimpse of what writers really talk about amongst themselves. Following Horatio, poet Claire Pollard celebrates the playfulness and variety of nonsense verse, sharing examples from across the centuries. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.